The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. After a weekend in which football paled into insignificance after the tragic helicopter crash in Leicester, in which the owner Vijay Srivaddhanaprabha and four others lost their lives. Meanwhile, former England manager and Tottenham midfielder Glenn Hoddle remains in a serious condition in hospital after suffering a heart attack at BT Sport on Saturday. Onto the football, we will look ahead to the Spurs game with Man City tonight. We'll look back at the weekend's action in the Premier League. Business as usual for Chelsea and Liverpool at the top of the table, while Arsenal's winning run is over after being held at Selhurst Park. At the bottom, Huddersfield and Fulham continue the bold tactic of not really bothering to defend at all. In Spain, we wait for Lopetegui to get fired just after we finish recording as Barca hammer them in El Clasico. And we'll round up the Football League, the rest of Europe, and take your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, mate.
And good morning, Barry Glendenning.
Hey, Max.
So yesterday, Leicester City confirmed their owner, Vijay Srivaddhanaprabha, was one of five who died after his helicopter crash just outside the King Power Stadium as it left their 1-1 draw with West Ham on Saturday evening. It was filmed leaving the stadium on BT Sport, then shortly after, eyewitnesses reported it getting into difficulty, then spinning quickly towards the ground. Leicestershire police have named the other four people, two members of his staff, Nusara Suknamai and Kavapon Punpare, and the pilot, Eric Swoffer, the pilot's partner, Isabella Rosa Leshowitz. Let's talk to the Guardian, Stuart James, who's covered Leicester for a long time for the newspaper. Stuart, good morning, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Good to speak.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Look, this is just such a tragedy, isn't it?
Absolutely. When you sort of first hear the news on Saturday night, it's just such a shock. And I guess, being honest, you just fear the worst straight away with something like this. It's hard to. It's really hard, I think, to try and convey just what Vijay did for Leicester, the football club, and the city and the community as well, really. And I guess, you know, in many ways, the players and the staff at the club have done that since the statement went out last night. And, you know, you see the sort of comments that are being made. And I think they go beyond a normal relationship between players and staff and a football club owner. I think that really shines through. Kasper Schmeichel's tribute in particular. I don't think you'd read something like that ordinarily when a player's talking about a chairman or owner. So that was Vijay, really. I think he's clearly an extremely wealthy man, but a very humble and modest man. Never really sort of courted publicity, didn't do any interviews. I find it very interesting that, you know, even the local guy, James Sharp, who's just recently left the Leicester Mercury, you know, he covered the club for 6 years, and the first time he exchanged any words with the owner was a couple of weeks ago, when he happened to be in Claude Puel's office and the chairman just poked his head round the door. And that was how he did things, really. I mean, when you think how spectacular that Leicester story was, you know, there have been lots of people who would have been, ready to say anything and everything. But that just wasn't Vijay's style. He wanted to stay in the shadows, really. But at the same time, you know, his actions spoke louder than words, really. He put so much money into Leicester. But it was more than that. It was more than putting money into it. I think he really fell in love with the club and the area. And that's why all of this is just is so tragic.
And you say as well what he did for the club, but what he did for the community as well, because I think a lot of people will have read a lot in the last 2 days about what he's done for Leicester and donating money to, you know, $2 million to a new children's hospital, yeah, $1 million to the city's university medical department. Just learning about just an owner, regardless of whether he's a foreign owner or just any owner, doing everything in exactly the right way.
Absolutely. And, you know, especially I think, you know, quite often we're, as journalists, sort of writing critical pieces about, football club chairman or absentee owners, if you like. And, Vijay really, he was the perfect owner. He respected the tradition of the club, and he really valued the local community. He didn't just sort of pay lip service to that. It was really genuine, and that's why the sense of loss is so great, really, and why you've seen those really sad images of people outside the stadium yesterday, and actually football fans coming from everywhere, because I think, you know, whatever football team you support, you have your own views and opinions on your owner, and I think, and also what's happening at other clubs, and I think people really saw that this was a really special guy, and he was absolutely at the centre of that amazing Leicester story, because you have to remember the mess that Leicester were in, really, when he first came in and got involved in the club in 2010. And actually, you know, I said he didn't do interviews. I think he did just about the only interview he did was in 2014 in Bangkok, when Leicester had won promotion back to the Premier League for the first time in 10 years. And he gave a press conference over there to some reporters. And he said then that he wanted Leicester to be in the top five in the Premier League within the next 3 years. And we all sort of laughed, really, and thought, well, there's no chance of that happening. And, you know, lo and behold, 2 years later, he was a Premier League champion. And you know, that's part of his legacy. But, you know, the other part is what you mentioned there, really, what he did, not just for the football club, but the whole area. It's just so, so sad. And I think, you know, I think this will, you've seen the sort of outpouring of emotion. I think it will really galvanise everyone at the club. Obviously, Top, Vichai's son, you'd assume would now sort of take control. Though really, it feels too early to talk about things like that. But I think we will see Leicester really pull together over the sort of weeks and months. And you know, everything that Vichai's vision for the club, that will carry on. Only earlier this month, the £100 million new training ground development had been given permission to go ahead. So, you know, you just hope that Leicester can somehow pull through this really, really difficult period. And I think a lot of people will get behind the club, not just from within Leicester, but outside of that too. And Vichai's legacy obviously will live on.
Stuart, we've seen how the people of Leicester are already pulling together.
Yeah.
And at some point, I suppose the grief will pass.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I suppose, is it trite to say that it will be weirdly fitting that the last steps Vichai took on this green earth were in the centre circle of the pitch at Leicester?
Yeah, I guess so, Raj. Yeah, it's, you know, and that was a sort of familiar scene, really. And you know, you thought nothing of it. You know, the helicopter coming in and going out, and that was just his, you know, how things are done, I guess, these days as well. I know David Conn did a piece this morning touching on that, how everything's changed and with football club ownership. But yeah, it does feel fitting in a way. It just feels so tragic as well that, you know, this was the place where, you know, those dreams were created. I can remember, I'll never forget that Everton game that day when the Premier League trophy was presented. And it was just amazing how Leicester handled that whole occasion that day. And, you know, to think that a little more than 2 years later, then he should lose his life just outside that stadium. It just feels so, so, so sad, really. But, you know, life goes on, obviously. And in time, you know, Leicester will hopefully pull through this. And I'm sure there will be so many tributes paid over the sort of days and weeks to come. I don't know what they'll do. Obviously, the game's been postponed tomorrow night. And then, I think due to play Burnley on Saturday week. I don't know if the League Cup game will potentially go in ahead of them, but whenever their next home game is, it's going to be such an emotional occasion. And yeah, very difficult for players and staff as well. And as I say, I come back to all those sort of tributes I was reading last night, and I just think they speak volumes for the man, really, because he was really close to the players. That was, you know, I don't think that would happen with a lot of owners. There was obviously respect for him, you know, so much respect. But, you know, there's that lovely line in Kasper Schmeichel's statement where he talked about the conversations they used to have in the, you know, in the changing room before the game. You know, when I came in early from my warm-up and had a chat about everything and nothing. And it sort of tells you that they could speak to him on a really comfortable level, really. It says so much, that. So, yeah, I just feel for everyone at the club, really. And it is obviously still some very difficult days ahead.
Stuart, thanks so much for coming on.
No problem. Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Stuart James there, who's covered Leicester for The Guardian for a long time. Yeah, that's what Kasper Schmeichel said. It's difficult to put into words how much you have meant to this football club, to this city of Leicester. You cared so deeply for not just the club, but the entire community. Your endless contribution to Leicester's hospitals and charities will never be forgotten. You changed football forever. You gave hope to everyone that the impossible was possible, not just to our fans, but to fans all over the world in any sport. And this came in from Irate Heskey, just saying, not a question, I know, but for clubs like Newcastle and Manchester United, something to consider about Vichai. He laid a template as to how owners should run a club, build a club, connect with the city, support its communities, and with pints and pies and T-shirts and donuts and clappers, remind us that football's actually fun and a celebration of where we're from and who we are. It seems quite... Lars, I don't know if you think that's...
Yeah, but that
could be his legacy, I guess.
I think it's a fair point, and I think that's part of... It's obviously an awful tragedy, but it's part of why it's resonating so much further than just the people who have an emotional attachment to Leicester, is because I think we all understand that in the modern era of the super clubs and the big money, you can't... The old model of having a local businessman done good, bankrolling the elite level team, that can't happen anymore because the sums are too big. So you do end up with these sort of global multi-billionaire characters. But if that's the way it has to be, then Vichai clearly was everything you can possibly hope for in an overseas owner, and a man who showed that you can be from the far side of the world yet completely buy into what a club means to the area and be as good a steward of that club as is possible to be. And it's one of the many reasons why this is so completely heartbreaking for everyone, not just for Leicester.
The game itself, I don't know if it doesn't, for some reason, it doesn't feel right to sort of analyse that game, but still we will analyse the rest of the Premier League. I don't know why I feel that that's the right thing to do. But
I think there was a good line in Jacob Steinberg's piece, just a throwaway thing, is that football's meant to be an escape. And that's part of why football is so important to us, because I think we all accept the world can be a harsh and unfair place, but football is kind of a place we go to escape from all of that. And another reason why this is so deeply tragic is that we kind of feel that the safe world has kind of been punctured by the sort of arbitrary disasters of life. But I think we do keep talking about the football because that's what we do, and it is still a place where we can sort of seek refuge from all this stuff.
Mm. Well, all our thoughts clearly go to everybody affected by that tragedy. On the pitch then, yeah, Leicester won, West Ham won. At the top, Burnley went down 4-0 at home to Chelsea. Jonathan, I said a few weeks ago on this pod, I wasn't really sure what type of footballer Ross Barkley was. I'm starting to find out that he's really good at it.
Yeah, I mean, he's scoring goals regularly. I think he is important to that Chelsea team because there's not a lot of goals from Jorginho and Kante and Kovacic. So to have somebody who can bring them goals from midfield, I think is valuable to them. And it's great for him that, I mean, I know his leaving of Everton maybe wasn't as harmonious as it might have been, but given the injuries he's had, it's great that he has sort of found a new start and kicked on.
And that pass, Lars, to Morata for the first goal was glorious, wasn't it?
It's amazing. It's so perfectly weighted. And just not just how perfect it is, but if you look at the footwork involved, like he had to be so quick, the first touch and then the pass, and then weighting it in such a manner is absolutely extraordinary. I also enjoyed reading that Barkley actually sort of prepared for playing under Sarri by watching videos of his Napoli, and he seems to be a guy who's very determined to make the most of his talents, and good on him for getting there.
Because you hear people say that, but you never believe. I'd never believe a current footballer would get the DVDs of...
Do you not?
No.
Like if you're in Barkley's position and that you're a young talent, you must know that you've not quite made it to the level you want, and there's a new and exciting manager coming in who represents a completely different style of play, something you've never done before. Would you not do some sort of research?
I just don't believe... Maybe it's you know, it's... I'd have a...
I would be inclined to agree with you, but I think in Barkley's position, like Antonio Conte gave the impression they never really wanted him in the first place. You know, he was brought in over Conte's head and didn't get a chance to, you know, Conte just wasn't interested. So it was very much a chance for a fresh start. Sarri clearly is investing a lot of time and energy in developing him, and that must be quite flattering for a player in his position who hasn't played regular football for quite a long time.
But at this point about doing research and watching videos, I remember like just a fascinating insight of a sort. Something had never occurred to me. It was in 2006. I was in Cairo, and having badgered the Cameroon press officer for days, he finally said, "Yes, you can interview Samuel Eto'o." And I went up to his room in the hotel, and he was in bed. Just lying in bed, watching some, I don't know what it was, some Arab League game. And so I said to him, what are you watching? Well, I don't really know. So why are you watching it then? And he went, well, without meaning to be patronising to these teams, they're not very good, and I'm used to playing against good teams, and I want to see where the space opens up when you're playing against a bad team. So I'm just, learning how I can adapt my runs when I play against poorer teams. And at the Cup of Nations, obviously, you do play against some poorer teams. And that was a fascinating thing to be doing.
Yeah. Well, maybe lots of footballers do it. Maybe I shouldn't have been so dismissive of this.
There's the other side of it, which is when Fabio Capello tried to teach Ibrahimovic how to be a proper striker at Juventus, and he sort of sat him down in a room and forced him to watch like endless videos
to kick all the Ajax out of him.
He was going to kick the Ajax out of him, and he made him do endless finishing practice and training, but he also sat him down in a room and just showed him videos of
isn't there a story as well that Zlatan sort of walked out halfway through and got bored,
he sat him down in a room and made him watch endless tapes of Marco van Basten scoring goals, whereas Ibra just sort of looked at it, and when Capello had left, he just sort of left and didn't watch it.
It's important, Lars, when you do your stand-up tour, that you don't have Wilson mic'd up in the front row.
I think it's far more important that I don't do a stand-up tour at all. I think that's the key.
As Stephen says, are Burnley going to do an Ipswich Town 2000-2002, a great season qualifying for Europe and go down the season after? It's going to be very hard to get relegated, really, for Burnley, given what's beneath them at the moment, Barry, isn't it?
I can't believe it's fallen to me to say this, but I really don't think they will. I think Sean Dyche will figure it out.
Oh, some love for Burnley from Lars. Paris?
Yeah, I would imagine they will be okay. It would be slightly worrying for them if the only reason they stay up is that there are three teams worse than them, but I would expect them to be all right. Although they do seem to be conceding an awful lot of goals and coming out on the wrong end of a few hidings.
So third worst defensive record in the league?
Is it right?
So there's only Fulham and Cardiff worse than them.
Well, let's talk about Cardiff. They lost 4-1 at Liverpool. So Liverpool are top of the Premier League. Salah, 2 for Mane, and a lovely goal from Jordan Shaqiri. I mean, we expected this last, didn't we?
Yes, Max.
Yes. Expected results, Liverpool to hammer Cardiff.
Yeah, I mean, what can Cardiff do? I mean,
they can not score. If they hadn't scored, they'd only lost 2-0.
Yeah, they've done really well to get promoted with the squad he has there, Neil Warnock, and they've been sensible in the sense that they haven't bet the house and farm on staying up by signing loads of players they can't actually afford. So they are in a position now where they're trying to stay up with a team that's like, with the best will in the world, probably not a Premier League squad, and so you go away to Liverpool, you're probably not going to have a good time.
Yeah, I mean, I know Cardiff are a particular case for all the reasons you've just outlined, but it does concern me that this is the future of football, that this kind of game is happening more and more, that a smaller team goes to a bigger team and it is not even a semblance of a contest. And I saw some stats, Ollie Kay did a piece in the Times over the weekend, looking at how the top six's results against the rest of the league had changed over time, and now, they slip up far, far less often. And I think, it's the way football's going, it's the way society's going, but it's an alarming trend.
And, Liverpool almost patronised them in a way because they rested three first-choice players, and it's only Cardiff we can field the second string in, Alberto Moreno, Lovren, Lallana. I know they're quite good second string, and Moreno
Fabinho played as well, didn't he?
Yeah. I thought Cardiff actually did okay, as good as they probably can do against a team like Liverpool, but they still get absolutely gobbed.
Yeah. I mean, that first goal, basically, there are so many Cardiff players just sort of trying to dive in front of the ball. It's so last ditch when like five of your players end up in the back of the net. Amazingly, that is the first goal that Liverpool have conceded at Anfield in the league since February. And I don't know why I have in my mind that they maybe it's just because we speak a lot about Salah, Firmino and Mane, that we just think about them as an attacking team, but that is an extraordinary record.
Yeah, their stats changed radically when Van Dijk came in. I can't remember exactly what they are, but I remember writing a piece about it a month or two ago. And they basically, since Van Dijk came in, they concede roughly a goal less per game. So I think that was probably a good signing.
It turns out it was. Yeah,
well, it was actually a Van Dijk error that led to the goal.
But that's also one of my hobby horses with Liverpool at the moment, is that with Van Dijk, they couldn't get him first time around, they tried, but they then didn't settle for the third and fourth choice centre half they had on their little list probably. They went, all right, we'll just wait until January then and throw as much money at it as we have to, because that's the player we want. And I think for such a long time with Liverpool, sorry, Rafa Benitez will say a few things about this, they kept not getting the first choice in terms of the players they wanted. They kept having to fall back on the slightly less expensive option and the slightly easier to get option, and not getting the guy. In Van Dijk, they went for the guy, and we criticised them that autumn for having a terrible defence because they hadn't signed anyone, but they got him in the end, and now they look so much better for it.
What are your other Liverpool hobby horses? But you just have one. Were you overstating the number of Liverpool hobby horses you have?
Probably.
That's okay. You're allowed to. Crystal Palace 2, Arsenal 2. Arsenal's 11-game winning run is over. Was a draw a fair result, Wilson?
I think probably. I was trying to watch it. I was at Old Trafford. I was trying to watch it across the Old Trafford press room, which is never the terrible press room, terrible viewing lines to the TV. And quite a mediocre roast dinner as well. But, I thought...
Is that Jose's fault, do you think?
I think it's indicative of a general shabbiness which has pervaded the club since the Glazers took over. The Wi-Fi doesn't really work, the food's not very good. To be fair, their roast is better than the curries they try and put on sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think generally facilities at Old Trafford have been left behind by modern developments. I think even things like their scouting. I mean, I ended up writing my piece on Martial yesterday, and I was trying to think who actually is who's the last bargain signing. I don't think you call Martial a bargain, but who is the last bargain signing for United who worked?
Cantona?
Well, I think it might be Vidic.
Okay.
And that's a long time ago.
It is.
And I sort of started to think about this after the Juve game, because I was looking at Bentancur and thinking what a great footballer he is, and I think he cost 6 million or maybe 8 million from Boca Juniors. You sort of think, why are United not buying that kind of player? Why aren't they taking a punt on somebody like that? And even if you get four of them and three of them don't work, you're still probably going to make your money back on them. But then if you get one who's as good as Bentancur. But anyway, well, the question wasn't about that, was it?
It wasn't a fair question, but since, I mean, obviously the lots of Manchester United fans will be excited to hear that the first 3 minutes of reviewing Crystal Palace Arsenal has been about the shabbiness of Manchester United. But why don't we carry on with United and then go back to Crystal Palace Arsenal in just a second. United beat Everton 2-1, Bilal says. Is there a media crisis now that Manchester United have won a game, and which heads will roll at the next anti-Mourinho meeting? Then he writes, tentatively writing this in the 69th minute when it was 2-0. Then Everton got one back, and I was praying just for this, how brilliant this tweet would seem after a 2-2 draw. But they played okay there, United, didn't they, Barry?
We're all right. I thought Everton were having the better of it and looked the more attacking side until United scored with a penalty I don't think they should have got. And
I've heard so many people saying, I've heard ex-professional footballers saying it's a penalty because it's lazy defending. But it doesn't matter how lazy Gay is. He still kicks the ball, right? It doesn't matter if you're lazy about it. It's not a penalty.
It's a lazy penalty. I mean,
it's a good run from Martial. Yeah. And you give him credit for that. You give him rather less credit for the weird, twisting dive. but Theo Walcott, what's he doing? Like, that goal came from Walcott losing possession cheaply. Mm,
that's true.
The second goal came from Walcott losing possession not quite as cheaply, and then not tracking back at all. There's twice as well in that game when Walcott got in good positions on the right side of the box, had Richarlison in the middle, and on one occasion somebody else coming in on the left, and didn't square, had a weak shot.
Do you think that's why Bernard didn't square it to Walcott? Because Walcott had made all those mistakes.
Just thought that was a... Yeah, it wasn't really the story, because Martial obviously was the story and the penalties were the story. But Walcott sort of just such a... what's the word, such a sort of self-indulgent, weak performance that if he'd been 17, he'd gone, oh, he'll grow out of that. He's 29. He annoyed me.
I can't get used to the size of Theo Walcott in an Everton shirt. Every time he flashes up on the screen, I just, oh yeah, I forgot. It doesn't look right.
I agree with that.
It just looks weird.
For equilibrium purposes, should we send him back to Arsenal?
Or perhaps Southampton. I don't think Arsenal would want him anymore.
Yeah, we don't want him to stop playing football altogether.
Not at all.
His first ever home game for Southampton.
He could go to Sunderland. I've only ever seen him really in red and white.
How would he get in Sunderland's team?
Hmm?
That Sunderland team as it is now, where does he fit? You know, he doesn't replace Gooch. I'd rather have Gooch than him.
Is that Graham Gooch? I hope it is.
Lyndon Gooch.
Lyndon.
Okay. Who I was there on Saturday. He had a very good game on Saturday. Maguire looks a proper player. And you got McGeady coming off the bench. I don't think Walcott gets in that squad.
You wouldn't have him in ahead of McGeady, no?
Oh, I don't really like McGeady, so yeah. I probably would. But McGeady took his chance very well on Saturday. Mm.
Just to confirm,
Has Aidan McGeady finally found his level?
he may well have done.
When Mel was here, did you cover the game she asked you questions about, or did you move on to other games? This sabotage, it sounds like.
She kept firm control.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But an iron fist in a velvet glove.
I thought Arsenal improved in the second half.
Listen, shut up, Watson. can we talk about Paul Pogba's run-up, Lars?
Okay, Paul Pogba's performance in general, I thought, was great. You have a goal, an assist, a missed penalty, and a mistake leading to a goal against. Can we, from now on, refer to that as a full Pogba?
Okay, that's
the way
the
breakfast is a full English, if it has a certain amount of things.
Yeah.
A performance, if you have all those things, it's a full Pogba.
Would you say the full Pog?
The full Pog.
Full Pog.
I'll take that.
And then they've got a good banterous post-match interview as well.
Exactly. Well, that should also be not part of the full Pog, but as like an extra that should be there.
You'd probably say he went the whole Pog.
The whole
you?
Pog, yeah.
What was the interview?
And nothing but the Pog.
He was taking the mickey out of Martial for not being able to speak English.
Right.
But can I just make it sort of semi-serious point about United, about how in this game I thought, it follows on the trend from the last couple of games, that they just look so much better when they're on the front foot. Because it's a really front-heavy team in terms of, like, their defence isn't very good, their attack is quite good, so you probably want to spend more time attacking than defending.
And how did Rashford playing instead of Lukaku in the sense of help that, or did it?
Well, he adds a bit of pace, I guess, and he perhaps opens up a bit more space for the other guys, but I thought it was more a general thing of they were more direct, they looked to get forward quickly, and just the team looks like it has a more sense of purpose when they're chasing something. I mean, we've seen this in the three games preceding this one, that the second they go behind, they actually look like a better team because then they're chasing the game and they're more comfortable doing that. So just maybe take the handbrakes off in general and let them attack and just accept that you'll probably concede now and again.
Do you know when the last time they won a home game by more than a single goal was?
No.
March.
Okay.
Against relegated Swansea.
I mean, that must be strange for Manchester United fans.
Yeah, well, I just think it's indicative of, you know, you sort of thought, we've been used to, I don't know, 25 years, that the bog standard United result was they beat a mid-table team 2 or 3-0 at home. And now we've gone, what month is it? October. We've gone 7 months without that happening.
Barry, can we just discuss Pogba's run-up for a short amount of time? Perhaps shorter than it takes for him to actually do it?
Well, his run-up took longer than it took Usain Bolt to break the world record for the 100 metres.
Makes you wish that when he broke the record, Pogba was in lane 6.
But Usain Bolt did not have Jordan Pickford staring him down at the end of his lane. Because that was why it took so long, right? He was waiting for Pickford to move, and Pickford kind of was not moving.
Yeah.
So it was this kind of game of chicken that...
it was an extraordinary run-up. I can't possibly think that it's a good idea. And it was a fantastic save, or fantastic bit of goalkeeping by Pickford, who was very unlucky. Or maybe it would be extremely harsh of me to say he should have, you know...
It's a good save and it could bounce anywhere. Yeah.
I mean, we got a question from listener Craig Lishman. What things can the pod do in the same time it takes for Pogba to run up to a penalty?
I imagine you can put away an entire lamb ticker down sack.
Obviously, but also based on what he told me before the show, it sounds like Wilson can do a full 10K run in that time.
Since the steroids, yeah.
Okay.
Anybody struggling for injuries form, I can... Steroids are brilliant.
Crystal Palace 2, Arsenal 2. Let's actually talk about it. Dr. Steve Mann says, two most predictable things to happen in a game of football ever. Lischsteiner leaving one on Zaha early, followed by Xhaka getting hoodwinked by Zaha for the penalty. Didn't need to be a respected journalist to see those coming. Barry?
No, it wasn't a very good performance by Arsenal. I'm going to make Crystal Palace fans very cross and say that I am convinced Wilf Zaha dived for that penalty. I believe he's only Jamie Vardy has won more penalties than him in the Premier League. And Skodra Mustafi gave away a penalty, and I would blame him for the second one as well, because he clearly should have... He had at least one, if not two, opportunities to take one for the team, as they say, and get a yellow that would have ended the attack. Who's the Norwegian fella for...
Solos.
He was advancing up the field. Mustafi had a couple of chances to bring him down, take a yellow card, and the ball would never have got to Zaha, who wouldn't have had the opportunity to get the penalty. But, it was just... Arsenal continue to look quite naive, you know. And again, yesterday they had another very slow start. This is... sort of becoming a chronic condition for them. The first half hour, they're still sort of half asleep. And I'm not sure how difficult a problem that should be to solve for Unai Emery, but it seems one that he hasn't addressed.
Do we all think that was a dive by Zaha?
Well, I've had this rant on the pod several times before. It's kind of both because, well, Xhaka interestingly agreed that it was a penalty and there's some sort of contact there, but it's also clear, like you say, that Zaha makes a decision to fall down. And that.
But there was contact, Lars.
that doesn't make any difference.
No.
No, I know.
I mean, there's nothing in the... I mean, there's this inane thing about you're entitled to go down if you feel someone touch you in the box. It's complete nonsense. Like, there's nothing about that in the rules. It's foolish. But I think it's also, it's become a culture now. And it also begins with referees, because if you stay on your feet, you're not given a foul, even if you are fouled. Mm-hmm. So players feel like they have to go down to show the referee, look, I've been fouled. And it's a very short way from there to going down every time you feel someone touch you. I think that's basically what's happened. And it's very annoying.
Depressed Tintin says, anyone else stoked for Salah versus Xhaka? It's Arsenal-Liverpool soon.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that, and both fullbacks, I mean, Lichtsteiner... I think was a really good fullback, but he's getting on a bit. He's still a decent player. He's brought an admirable level of shithousery to Arsenal, which they've lacked for some time. But pace against him, and you think, I know Liverpool's formation was a little bit different on Saturday. It was more of a 4-2-3-1. But if they get Salah and or Mane against those two fullbacks, I mean, I was surprised Zaha wasn't switched to have a go at Xhaka earlier.
Yeah.
And whether it was a dive or not, that was clearly a vulnerability for Arsenal. Liverpool's pace and wide areas against those two Arsenal fullbacks, I think, is a concern.
Would anybody like me to read them the description of Arsenal's third kit? This was tweeted to me by Kenny B. Introducing the new Arsenal Adult 18-19 short-sleeved third kit, which is offered in a light green with dark blue detail. This shirt features a concealed one-button placket with a fold-over collar offering a smarter look when worn casually. The dark blue detail includes a form stripe sublimation graphic flowing down each sleeve with a two-stripe panel on the cuffs and the diamond-cut pulse design running through the middle, all making for an eye-catching design. The dry cell within the material will help you keep you dry during exercise by drawing moisture away from the skin, and the asymmetric style will not ride up the back when arms are raised, all offering a comfortable and relaxed fit. Did anybody like it?
So, it's not as bad as Tottenham's away kit.
Oh, I was expecting a bit more wrath from anyone.
It's just like an old Coventry shirt or something. Nice. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, better if they just stuck him in an old Subaru Coventry kit. anyway, I was expecting more, but, you know, if you're all happy with it.
You're not in favour, not a fan?
Well, I have a campaign for people to not change their kit unnecessarily, and I would agree that you probably shouldn't wear the red Arsenal kit against Crystal Palace, although you feasibly could and it would be fine. If that was the only kit you'd brought on the coach, it would be okay. But I would rather Arsenal went for their
yellow
Stefan Schwartz yellow. Yes.
JVC across the front.
Yeah, that's what I would like. On that important note, we'll end part one. We'll begin part two with Fulham forgetting to defend again. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. If you like other podcasts, Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from the Guardian. Every weekday, you'll hear a different side to the news from those at the heart of the story. Hosted by Anushka Astana, every weekday you'll hear personal stories and fresh perspectives so you get a deeper understanding of the world. Listen to Today in Focus, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Fulham 0, Bournemouth 3. Barry, Fulham's defending is spectacular in its absence, isn't it?
It's truly terrible. I mean, I would imagine if to see a top flight team defending that badly, and they weren't the only ones who defended that badly on Saturday, because Huddersfield were possibly even worse. It's quite a remarkable thing, because I imagine even on the team you play for on a Saturday afternoon, you would be appalled with that level of incompetence. Mm.
I think there was a goal last week where I forget who Fulham were playing. The winger just got the ball out wide and just ran.
Oh, it was Josh Murphy.
Yeah.
For Cardiff.
Yeah, so Josh Murphy just ran with the ball and then just put it in the corner. It was just ludicrous that nobody went to challenge him. It's like at some point someone would shout, "Go to the ball."
Yeah. I mean, there's no shame in losing to this Bournemouth team, who are very good, and they're particularly good up front. And luckily for Fulham, Josh King was ruled out through injury, so didn't play. But even so, Callum Wilson and Ryan Fraser absolutely ran amok. They eviscerated the Fulham defence with through balls. It was very worrying to see. And there is a suggestion that there is a rift in the Fulham camp, that some players are aggrieved because they've been marginalised after helping them win promotion. All these new players have come in during the summer, aren't playing well, aren't justifying their fees and have taken the places of these players who are, you know, understandably miffed at being sidelined. And they've got serious problems there. Jokanović, I think they play Huddersfield next week, and you would think if they don't win that game, because, you know, Huddersfield, who are having serious difficulty scoring, they'll fancy the chances of filling their boots there as well, and that could be, you know, just the sort of trip to the Priory they need to get their season going. But I'm surprised, because I did the Fulham season preview for our series, and I thought they'd be absolutely fine, and they're shipping exactly three goals a game, and they're not scoring four per game, so they're only going one way at the moment.
We mentioned Martial's dive and Zaha's dive, but Aboubakar Kamara definitely wins the award. Lars, I mean, it was Jonathan Pearce on Match of the Day. I've never heard him so angry about anything.
Oh, he was far more sanctimonious when Eric Cantona got sent off.
That's a magnificent bit of commentary.
Yeah, that's true.
When he kung fu kicked the...
Where can it be? A place in the game.
To be fair, Cantona did launch himself into the crowd. I mean, that's a sort of legitimate.
Yeah, but
time.
No, but he does that after the kicking out Richard Shaw.
Fair play, I'll take it back. Yeah.
So he was already at the outer limits of his outrage when Cantona got sent off, and then he had to crank it up a notch when he dived into the crowd. So
I checked into my flight to Moscow in the summer behind Jonathan Pearce, and he wasn't happy in that queue either.
All right.
He's a man prone to the odd eruption.
Was he advocating lifetime bans for everyone involved there as well?
This is a terrible analogy, but like an old Parker ink pen had that extra bit of ink at the top in a cartridge that Jonathan Pearce has all this rage, and then he can just tap that bit at the top to get the absolute full Pearce rage. Anyway, so that was Fulham 0, Bournemouth 3. Watford 3, Huddersfield 0. You said the defending was terrible. Was the attacking brilliant? I mean, the goals from Pereira and Delafeu are lovely goals.
Well, the Pereira goal's a bit weird. One of those goals I end up being quite disappointed by, having the first time I saw it thinking, that's brilliant, I don't know what he's done there. I tell you what he'd done there was run not that quick in a straight line.
Yeah.
As players sort of collapsed around
him. He didn't even have to, like, dribble the ball. He just touched it once about 5 yards ahead of him, ran after it.
The finish was good. Like having,
yeah.
I mean, presumably he was as bewildered as anybody else.
Do you know how football is famously difficult to recreate in films and TV shows because it ends up looking rubbish? That was the kind of goal that you'd expect to see in an advert or in, like, Goal 4, the unexpected fourth film. It just didn't seem like real football, what they were doing in attempting to defend.
I remember fantasy football, you know, the Badillion Skinner, the good version, not the one I did. They found an old Weetabix advert from the 60s or 70s. And basically this one striker is running through and there are all these sliding tackles. And they counted 15 sliding tackles coming in. As if at least the first five had got up and run round and slid again. Arguably the worst ever Maisie dribbled goal of all time, Pereira's then.
Well, it was nowhere near as good as it looked originally.
It's a good goal, but it just sort of... You sort of come to resent it because it's nowhere near as good as you thought it was when you first saw it. Whereas Delafeu's goal is genuinely excellent, I think. Mm. And even the finish.
I would say Lossell, he's turned into a bit of a liability. Well, possibly, although with that defence in front of him, it's no surprise.
That finish was hit so hard with a surprising amount of dip on it. I give him a bit of a pass on that. But I agree with you. I don't think he's had a great season.
There was one stage where Isaac Success dribbled past two defenders and Matthias Jorgensen almost ended up poking it into his goal in a sort of incident that was so calamitous defensive-wise. I think if he had scored into his own goal, Huddersfield, the match should have been ended and Huddersfield relegated on the spot.
Brighton 1 Wolves 0, 3 consecutive 1-0 wins for Brighton. Glenn Murray's 100th goal for the club. I presume, Lars, the stats are not fair and Brighton are becoming the new Burnley.
No, they're just quite solid. They're not as outrageous as the sort of Daishin stats were.
But are Wolves the anti-Burnley? Because, I mean, they've only scored 9 goals this season.
Yeah.
Despite, whenever I watch them, they seem to be piling forward on the attack constantly. That's 27 shots.
Poor old Raul Jimenez, who is one of those strikers who's really good at getting into positions and moving into the right place.
Twice as many goals as any other Wolves player this season.
Not very good at finishing the chances that come his way.
Rex says, how many goals would Glenn Murray have to score to warrant a cursory Ricky Lambert-esque England call-up and inevitably a goal as well?
There was talk last year that a few months before the World Cup, that he might possibly or get a call-up or is under consideration for a call-up. I don't think it'll happen now, but...
England did quite well recently, I seem to remember.
Well, one man's doing quite well is another man's blowing the greatest opportunity to win a World Cup you've had since winning the last World Cup.
No, I've moved on since then. I was just talking about the Spain game. 100 goals for Brighton. Tommy Cook, officially recognised by the club as their top scorer, with 123 in 209 appearances from 1922 to 1929. But Bert Stevens scored 174 goals between 1935 and 1948. Only 87 of them in competitive matches. So really the war.
The untold cost of the Second World War.
Absolutely, for Bert Stevens.
It was interesting, this game. Like, Fulham have fielded a different defence in 12 consecutive games this season. Wolves, by contrast, made their first change to their starting lineup against Brighton. Diogo Jota was dropped. I don't think he scored yet this season. And Adama Traore came in instead of him. I thought Wolves played very well in this game despite losing, and it was a good win for Brighton because they really had to dig in and earn it.
There was a brilliant piece of defending from Shane Duffy when he...
Yeah.
There was a free kick. Was it Neves? Was basically put it in the top right-hand corner.
It was going in.
It definitely like was going in, and Duffy to sort of run back and head that clear. There is something glorious about Duffy and Dunk. I think, I don't know if you all agree or disagree. I think
Bong. It's a great.
Oh, someone sent a tweet about this goal. Bruno to Glenn Murray. Is that the oldest goal in the Premier League? 73 years old, that assist and finish for Brighton.
It's pretty generous calling that an assist.
Yes, you're right. Well, he is old, isn't he?
Can I briefly amend my previous statement? Actually, Brighton statistics are getting kind of Burnley-esque there. They have the second most shots against them in the league and produce the lowest number of shots per game of anyone. So actually, I was completely wrong. Their stats are way into Burnley territory right now.
I mean, at current, you know, time of recording, do you hate Burnley more than Brighton, or...?
I don't hate anyone. Well, that's definitely not true, but I don't hate any of them.
Okay. Who does Lars hate? We'll find out.
I think Chris Hughton has a responsibility to everyone to set up his team so that we once have a midfield of proper Gross and Bung.
I agree with you entirely.
If he doesn't do that, then I might hate them a little bit.
Okay, fine. Southampton 0, Newcastle 0. Barry, did you enjoy this?
No.
last time Newcastle failed to win any of their opening 10 games, 120 years ago.
Great. I mean, there's not a huge amount you can say about this. Southampton have failed to score for the fifth game in a row. Ings, Austin, Long, Gabbiadini. Over to you, Max.
He is 50.
Yeah. they're just dreadful at the moment.
Does anybody will Shane Long? I will him to score. I'm so desperate for Shane Long to score. He had another chance late on, didn't he, that he put wide.
And the look on Nathan Redmond's face when he didn't score. And to be honest, it was a good chance, but it wasn't. Like, I didn't think it merited the look of amused disbelief that crossed the countenance of Nathan Redmond.
Do you think
Redmond.
He might have just seen himself in the mirror and realised that he's well on the way to becoming Nuno Espirito Santo? He's just a young version of him, Nathan Redmond.
Is he?
Yeah. Look at the picture of the two of them next to each other. They're the same man, just 20 years apart in age.
I'll check that out.
Southampton seem to have a lot of players on their bench who are better than the players in their team. Obviously, don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but I would imagine James Ward-Prowse should be one of the first names on the Southampton team sheet. I don't think Aurel Romeo is a regular starter, which I think he should be. Again, Southampton fans may beg to differ. And Mayo Yoshida seems to be cast into the wilderness as well, and I think he's probably better than what they have. But again, Southampton fans are welcome to disagree in the most strident possible terms.
Would you like to disagree, Lars?
Well, I would just unleash my massive Nordic bias here and say I actually think Moy Elunosi is a really good player. I just think he's in a very difficult situation. Making the step up from the Swiss League to the Premier League is tough for a young creative player. I remember when that transfer happened, I was with a certain Norwegian player who may have... Well, I was with Johan Risa, who made the point immediately that he thought it was going to be really tough for him because basically being a creative player and maybe... If you look at the team on paper, maybe the main creative outlet in a not very good Premier League team is a really, really difficult job. Mm. I think if you put someone like Moy Elunosi into Bournemouth in their line of front three, I think he'd play very, very well. But it's a tough gig at the moment.
Hey, he did have a great opportunity to square the ball, didn't he?
Yes.
Great. To Gabbiadini, but that's fine. Spurs play City tonight. Look, first of all, we obviously want to send our best wishes to Glenn Hoddle. It was taken seriously at BT Sports Studio on Saturday. They cancelled their score programme. He's in a serious condition, is responding well to treatment, according to the hospital. And huge credit to a man called Simon Daniels, member of the production crew, is also a special constable who gave him immediate medical attention. He's been credited with saving his life, basically. I started watching great Glenn Hoddle goals this morning because it's just an absolute hero of mine. If you are too young to remember him playing, I tweeted them out this morning, but just go and search out Glenn Hoddle because such an unbelievable footballer. Spurs City tonight, and most people are talking about the Wembley pitch currently because the drunk Jacksonville Jaguars, if you didn't hear that story, four of them were arrested on Friday night for racking up a £50,000 bar bill and not paying it. And then they lost on Sunday to the...
What a huge surprise.
The Philadelphia Eagles, I think, beat them. Anyway,
what's the biggest bar bill you've ever racked up, Barry?
Over the course of a three-day cruise around the Whitsunday Islands in Australia, about $400. It's not much.
Any advances on that?
Don't know what that's worth.
About 200 quid.
I once took the football team to karaoke, and at the end of the dinner, it was like you get a Chinese meal and, you know, there's a karaoke sing song. It was lots of fun. And at the end, it was like, right, instead of everyone paying, I'll just pay it now, and then I'll get all the money back from you. And it was, I think it was £1,100. And they're really embarrassed. I sent the receipt to the WhatsApp group. The worst bit is just, I didn't tip at all. The service was absolutely outstanding. It was 11 British gratuity, nil. And I just woke up and said, oh no, that's a disaster. I trust my team. I eventually think I got most of them back. Anyway, the Wembley pitch, Lars.
Yeah. Not good.
Not good. And the thing is, Spurs also like to play quite good football as well, don't they? They're not going to be, it's not like that. It's not like it's Wimbledon playing Man City.
Yeah, and also, not in a great... I don't think Spurs are in a brilliant state at the moment. They've been getting results, and it's bizarre.
You see the Pochettino stuff this morning? Yeah. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, very, very
interesting. He's never been as down since he got
to
Tottenham.
Almost as if that's where I was going with that sentence.
Oh, sorry.
The Lars and Wilson show. I want to watch it.
You have such a bleak start to these things, don't
you? So,
but Pochettino's not saying that because... Well, we'll talk to Sid in a second, that some job might be coming up soon in Spain.
But Pochettino's usually quite guarded with his media comments. And he's gone... this is his version of going all in, I think. And
this is his Jonathan Pearce moment.
Well, what he's saying is... it's strange because my feeling is the worst feeling I've had in the 5 years that I've been here. It's the worst, but it's the best start ever for a club in the Premier League. It's strange, no? And I don't know, it's difficult to explain the circumstances because many things happen. I'm disappointed we're still waiting for the new stadium when the expectation was to be there at the time of the beginning of the season. I don't know, many things happen in the summer, many things that make myself not in my best mood or best humour. I know I always have a good relationship with you, but my feeling is not the best feeling. I had better feelings in previous seasons.
Are you sure he's not just saying this because Spurs have the capacity to be absolutely belted by City in the same way that Liverpool beat them even though they only won 2-1?
Yeah, I suspect they will be absolutely belted by City because they've been scraping wins against quite poor teams, whereas City have been even better, I think, than the league suggests. In theory, but he's not wrong. Like, them not signing anyone this summer is quite extraordinary, and he's actually now what he's been doing. He's been quite. It's also either Poch's way or you're out. Like, he's been freezing out players who are not on the Pochettino bandwagon. Whereas now he's actually been forced to take people back in who he had previously been shunted aside because they weren't able to do the business they wanted to do in the summer. And I think that's probably a situation he's not very happy with. And it's just, I don't think Spurs are in. I think Spurs are in quite a vulnerable situation. I wrote a piece last week about how they're a bit of a house of cards at the moment. There are a lot of things that can cause it all to tumble down, and
anyone give Spurs a hope tonight? I do, because I want them to win, but I don't actually.
No, I mean, they got battered twice last season by City. I mean, the 4-1 at the Etihad was perhaps was a very comfortable City win. But, I mean, that game, I think you saw the build up. You'd sort of thought, well, Tottenham pressed so well, maybe they can disrupt City, and it turned out that Edison could just play endless 50-yard passes to feet. And so what he actually meant to do against them. And the game at Wembley last year was really flat. And although it was 3-1, if anything, it was sort of City were even more dominant in that game.
All right. Well, that'll do for the Premier League. Let's... it's like you've never seen a microphone before, Jonathan, isn't it?
I was reaching for my water and I hit the thing.
Sorry. Yeah, and then... Well, that's fine, but it was kind of your reaction as... I've never seen anyone look more like a Victorian lady. Swooning.
Anyway, that'll do for the Premier League.
Your peril. Sorry.
No, that's okay. That'll do for the Premier League. Keep it all in. Producer Claire, we're on our third producer. We're getting through them. Reserve producer Sammy's got appendicitis.
He's been carved open, but we'll still edit the pod.
Producer Claire is the Peggy Arfaxed of the Gazzaniga of the pod.
But ironically, Gazzaniga is arguably better than Michel Vorm and should probably play more.
That's a good point. Are you saying Claire's better than Sammy?
I mean, I have no way
of knowing. Pretty harsh on a man who's lying there with a hole in his stomach where the penalty used to be.
Anyway, let's move on to Spain and talk to Sid Lowe because, well, Real Madrid are about to sack their manager. Sid, hello.
Hello, everybody.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. This is a question from Luis, who says, can Barry tell me in his most soothing voice that everything is going to be okay? A Real Madrid fan here.
I really hope everything isn't okay because I hate Real Madrid.
Sid, is everything going to be okay?
Well, I mean, the risk, I mean, certainly let's start with Sergio Ramos, shall we, from last night. What will happen almost certainly, in fact, by the time this is up and published, it may well have already happened. What will happen is that Julian Lopetegui will get the sack. And unless something goes wrong in the kind of the final stages of getting everything tied up, Antonio Conte will become the manager. Now, the reason I say let's start with Sergio Ramos is, as you say, things will get better, won't they? Well, there's a fear from some members of the squad, and Sergio Ramos is one of them, and he expressed this last night, that actually things could still get worse. Ramos was asked last night about how he felt about someone like Conte, and in particular, the question was framed around the idea, which is one that's being pushed very much by the club's president at the moment, that what this dressing room needs is a manager with an iron fist, that this dressing room needs someone who imposes upon them, someone who kind of brings authority to the team, and someone who doesn't allow this group of players, who of course have won three Champions Leagues in a row, to drift. Now, what Ramos said last night, and obviously, you know, this is about as direct and as clear and as obvious as you could possibly be. Ramos said, respect is won, it's earned, it's not imposed. And he said, and you have seen that we have been successful with managers who I don't need to name, but you know what kind of managers. He and some of the other members of the squad are not at all happy about the idea of someone like Conte, or even Jose Mourinho, which was another name that certainly the president of the club would love to bring in if he could at some point. And they don't like that idea at all. And of course, he's right as well. If you look at their recent successes, it has tended to be with managers who get on very well with a squad, managers who are relatively indulgent of them, who don't treat them as kind of people to impose upon. And Ramos, you know, Ramos said last night, it's as important to know how to manage a dressing room as it is to have the kind of technical ability or technical know-how, technical knowledge. And I think that's a very direct, we don't want Antonio Conte here. Now, the problem with this is that in a way, the squad saying this, and in a way, the squad supporting Julian Lopetegui, which they've done, as the Spanish phrase goes, a little bit with a small mouth. In other words, they've said it, but it's largely been platitudes. But there's one or two comments that have been actually a bit more powerful in supporting Lopetegui. Doesn't actually help Lopetegui at all, because of course, as I say, the president's feeling is that one of the big problems that Lopetegui has had, and the fundamental one, is that he's been too indulgent in this squad. So when the squad says we want Lopetegui, it almost proves to him that, right, we've absolutely got to get rid of Lopetegui, quite apart from the fact that the results are embarrassingly bad and they're down in ninth at the moment. So I think this will happen anyway. I think the fact that Ramos expressed very publicly that he didn't want it to happen will actually only increase the resolve to make sure it does. And as I say, I think it will happen really quite soon.
Dan, amongst lots of other people, has asked, can you think of a worse managerial decision than Lopetegui taking the Madrid job pre-World Cup? It's stunning, isn't it?
It really is. And you know, at the time, we talked about this at the time in the summer, you know, even then, I mean, I know it's partly cruel. I know it's partly just kind of the knee-jerk thing of saying, we'll see. But I think even then, we're all saying, what, you just gave up all of this so that they can sack you in 6 months' time? Because I think we all felt that was likely to happen. As it turns out, it's not 6 months, it's only four. Julian Lopetegui, I think, has been in charge of 12 games at Real Madrid. He's lost as many as he's won. And I think as well, I mean, this might be overstretching it a bit. And I wonder what you lot think in kind of terms of interpreting it through this kind of view. I think as well, part of the problem that Lopetegui has had at Real Madrid was precisely the way that he came into this, was precisely the fact that from the very start, this was conditioned by that sense of disappointment at everything he'd lost in the World Cup. Of course, he didn't expect to be sacked for taking the Real Madrid job. And I think if he'd handled it differently, this might not have happened. If Real Madrid had handled it differently, it certainly wouldn't have happened. But it's also true, of course, that the Federation at the time could have said, all right, well, let's deal with this the best way we can. You're still the right manager for the World Cup. You carry on and then you go to Real Madrid afterwards. But I think that it was kind of born badly, this whole Real Madrid project. And I think partly because, in a way, he expressed his own weakness, his own desperation for the Real Madrid job by allowing it to be managed in that way. And I think that's had an impact on the way that this has all gone. And as you say, you know, he's now been sacked from the two biggest jobs in the world in 4 months. And some people might say they're not the two biggest jobs in the world. For a Spaniard, they are. For a Spaniard, there's no doubt. These are the two biggest jobs in the world. He was only ever going to get one chance to possibly win the World Cup with Spain. He believed he was only ever going to get one chance to manage Real Madrid. And unfortunately, by taking one because he thought it wouldn't come round again, he lost the other. He's basically fucked it up big style.
Beautifully put. How bad were Real Madrid or how good were Barcelona in that 5-1 yesterday?
Well, the curious thing is, for some of the game, it didn't seem this bad. as 5-1. And yet, for some of the game, it seemed a hell of a lot worse. And I know that sounds silly, but let me try and explain. In the first half, Barcelona completely dominated the game. Actually didn't create a huge amount of chances. I think it was the two goals they scored and then maybe one or two others. And there's the shot from Artur, and I think there's a PK header, and but not a huge amount. But it wasn't really the number of chances. It wasn't really the stats. It was the sensation. And the sensation really was just that, crikey, if they put their foot down on the accelerator here, Barcelona, they will absolutely destroy Real Madrid. And Madrid played very deep, very, very little edge, very little aggression, they were just absent. It was a really quite pathetic thing to see in the kind of literal sense of the word. It was genuinely almost a little bit sad. But then at halftime, they made a tactical change, partly driven by injury. Went for three at the back, put two wing-backs on, and really went for Barcelona. And for about 20 minutes, caused Barcelona a huge amount of problems. Got the goal back, hit the post. Benzema misses a really good chance with a header. Sergio Ramos has a header that goes just over. And Barcelona were a bit ragged at that point and a bit overwhelmed. But they came through that and then made changes of their own and then just tore Madrid to bits in the end. And Madrid completely collapsed. So by the end, you know, it's 5 goals and 5-1 might not entirely tell the story of the game, but by the end of it, it felt like it. I quite like the comment made by Javier Cáceres, who writes for, I'm going to say this wrong, is it Süddeutsche Zeitung? Anyway, that German newspaper. And he described this as being like a Banksy painting, that Real Madrid were like a Banksy painting. For a moment, now the recent one that was at auction, for a moment there was something there and it looked like it might be good. But then suddenly it just kind of got shredded before their eyes and they were just torn into little pieces. And Real Madrid were, well, basically rubbish. Casemiro was very good post-game. He said, we are a disaster. All of us are a disaster. And most importantly of all, he said, this game is a portrait of our season. It's not a one-off.
Sid, no Cristiano Ronaldo, no Leo Messi. Did it sort of make the occasion a little weird?
Yes, it did. And I think we all thought it was going to make the occasion quite a lot weaker and quite a lot less. Leo Messi was there, by the way. Leo Messi was playing the very important role of babysitter to Luis Suarez's two kids, well, two of his three kids. And so he played a vital role in this because he enabled Luis Suarez to go on the pitch, feel very comfortable and score a hat-trick. I think, you know, I say this as someone, of course, who's kind of written quite a lot about the Clásico and always make the point that the Clásico is still huge. This game is still huge no matter what is, and it will always find a way through. And Ernesto Valverde, Barcelona manager, was asked about this before the game. He said, look, before Messi and Ronaldo, there were still games, there was still tension, there was still rivalry, there was pigs flying through the air. And so, of course, it is still big. But I do think it's genuinely true that in the history of this game, of this rivalry, there haven't been two players that have dominated a decade quite like these two. And it did feel a little bit weird. And it was kind of a glimpse of, wow, what happens when Messi goes and when we've lost both of them and it really is over. But as I say, because of the brilliance of the performance in particular from Sergio Roberto, from Jordi Alba, the two men who came on actually were very good as well, both Arturo Vidal and Dembele, but especially Luis Suarez, who was absolutely fantastic. I suppose that meant that whole thing was kind of overlooked. And there's a nice line in AS, I think it is, Santi Jimenez, a friend of mine, who says, you know, lots of people are saying, you see, that proves you didn't need Messi. He said, no, with Messi, this would have been a Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Any of those pigs flying through the air, you haven't caught them and put them in your big ham garage, have you, Sid?
No, because I think there's a significant difference between the seeping, severed head of a pig and a kind of nicely encased leg of one.
I agree, and the fact that you know the difference means I'm more likely to take a ham sandwich from you if offered, I would say. Thanks for coming on, Sid.
My pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll round up FITBAR, the Football League, and the rest of Europe. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly FITBAR. Barry, Adam says, for FITBAR, if Pogba was a proclaimer, how long would it take for him to walk 500 miles? Anyway, thank you for that, Adam. In the Scottish League Cup semi-finals, it was a 3-0 win for Celtic over Hearts in the first one. Scott Sinclair scored a penalty. James Forrest and Ryan Christie with the goals. Aberdeen beat Rangers 1-0. A late goal from Lewis Ferguson means it won't be an Old Firm Scottish League Cup final. Aberdeen will play Celtic. In the Football League, Sheffield United returned to the top of the Championship following a 4-2 victory over Wigan at Bramall Lane. Billy Sharp, who must be like 72 years old now, scored his first hat-trick since 2008 to take his tally to 11 for the season. Leeds are second. They drew 1-1 with Nottingham Forest. Lots of people getting in touch saying, could Kemar Roofe be put in the future shithousery 11 for that handball. I don't know if any of you saw it. He had to readjust his body, and he definitely just punched it in, or it went off his arm. Not really sure how the linesman didn't see it, but he didn't, and so Leeds equalised. Tied on points with Leeds and Middlesbrough, who drew with Derby, and Norwich, who've now won their last three after defeating Brentford. Notice Norwich win when Mel isn't on the pod. Just thought I'd point that out after she suggested Cambridge should... if Cambridge keep winning, I should probably just take myself away from the pod for the goodness of Cambridge United.
But to be fair, Norwich also won when she was on the pod. So,
well, Cambridge also won when I was on the pod, just to point
it's
that out.
Almost like these things are independent.
bottom side Ipswich Town have hired Paul Lambert to try and keep them in the Championship. Barry, you having some nice chats with Ipswich fans on social media over the last few days?
They're a very angry bunch. One of them threatened to... Well, he told me he was going to do unspeakable things with my mum. Then I pointed out that my mum was 76. She might be glad of the attention.
Oh, please.
And she sent me a text to tell me in no uncertain terms that she would not.
So your mum is reading your Twitter, or did you...
Yeah, she was reading the Twitter.
Is she at Mama Glendening, if anyone wants to Twitter?
I don't think she has her own account.
Okay.
But, I continue to have a bee in my bonnet about the abuse Ipswich fans subjecting Mick McCarthy to last season. And they continue to tell me that his football was boring. I don't care whether it was boring or not. It didn't justify the kind of abuse he was getting. But anyway, they got rid of McCarthy. They're now bottom of the league. I think it's hilarious. And Paul Lambert... is gone to manage them. He's the only man ever to manage both East Anglian sides. And Melissa, who was in for you last week, is heartbroken. She's genuinely distraught that he's gone to Ipswich, and said hearing him say he'd give his all for Ipswich Town was like a dagger through the heart.
Wow.
I thought that was quite the overreaction myself.
So anyone going to Ipswich.
But there you go. I mean, you know, bloke goes to manage provincial football team with fans who tell me they're going to have relations with my mum. I don't care.
Ian Herbert,
I hope
says,
they go down. I really do.
West Brom 1, Blackburn 1. The Rovers keeper, David Rea, got a really bad injury. We wish him all the best. But they've made all their substitutes. So Richie Smallwood went in for a comedy 17 minutes of sort of flapping crosses away. Ian Herbert says, what are the panel's views on outfield players in goal? Personally, I'd make it compulsory for every team, every match for the last 10 minutes based on Saturday's entertainment. One of the greatest things in football?
Niall Quinn... famously for Sunderland, scored the winner at Bradford and then went in goal for the last few minutes, and we won 1-0.
He saved the penalty for Man City,
as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
Dean
he's actually
Saunders.
Very competent. I think, presumably, something to do with his Gaelic football background.
Yeah, he was a very good Gaelic footballer and hurler. I think he used to regularly in training sessions go in goal, and anyone who could have 50-quid bets with various players that they couldn't score three in a row past them. And not too many were able to do it. So,
big lad though, makes it easier.
Yeah. Actually, I think hurling was actually his Gaelic game of choice.
He went in goal as a substitute, you know, when they'd used all their subs, did he have a big stick or not?
No, he didn't. But he the best goal Niall Quinn ever scored was in a hurling match, not a football or soccer match.
In League One, Sunderland and Peterborough gained 2 points on leaders Portsmouth after Portsmouth drew with sixth place Accrington Stanley, who are doing an amazing job to be where they are. Sunderland comfortably beat Southend 3-0. Posh won 2-1 away at Burton, disappointingly. In League Two, no wins for any of the top four. Lincoln lost to Colchester. They stay top. MK Dons in second drew at Mansfield. Exeter lost to Forest Green and Newport drew with Morecambe. Kevin says, can I take the opportunity, Max, to thank your beloved Cambridge for winning my ACCA yesterday? Yes, we've won two in a row. A 1-0 win over Macclesfield. Manager Joe Dunn apologised for how bad the game was. Despite winning, we are now in the giddy heights of 20th. Richie says, can you give a mention to the mighty Carlisle United, who are now 5 home games on the bounce without a point or a goal? A new record. What a time to be alive. # CUFC. Yes, Barry?
Did they have to go to Plymouth or somewhere as well? Or did Plymouth come to them? It's quite the trek anyway for whoever they were playing. Mm,
there's always a local reporter who gets on the coach to see what it's like. And you're like, surely you've been on a coach before. it takes a long time and it's really boring.
Our old friend Ian McIntosh did it last season or the season before.
When you say old friend, what do you mean?
I mean our old friend Ian McIntosh.
Okay. Not like a former friend.
I invite you to interpret my remark however you see fit.
Let's go from the Football League and get some European roundups from Paolo on Italy and Archie on Germany. They may well record these after we've done the pod, so that's why we don't react to them in any way. It doesn't mean, Paolo and Archie, we don't like you. We just don't know what you've said. First up, here is Paolo Bandini on Italy.
So it's a big weekend in Italy for Gennaro Gattuso, who's coming under real pressure at Milan after successive defeats to Inter and Real Betis. He saw his team recover from a goal down to beat Sampdoria 3-2. And for the first time this season, he paired Gonzalo Higuain with Patrick Cutrone up front. And both of them scored. Italian also set up the Argentinian for his goal with a lovely little 1-2 on the edge of the box. And this was a good win against a Sampdoria team that arrived with the stingiest defence of all of Serie A. And there's definitely something exciting about seeing this combination between Cutrone, who's a 20-year-old homegrown talent, and Higuain. They seem to have a really good understanding with each other and be seeking each other out, when a lot of people were worried that the two of them, both being natural number nines, would not be able to play together. Having said that, Milan have now conceded 13 goals already this season. They haven't kept a clean sheet in 15 matches dating back to last season, which is the worst the club has seen as a sequence since 1946. We've got some real problems unaddressed at the back, and I think we're going to be talking plenty more about Gattuso's position in the weeks and months to come, because they absolutely need to get back into the Champions League for financial reasons, for financial fair play reasons, as well as just flat paying the bills reasons. Elsewhere, Napoli left it late to grab a draw at home to Roma. This was a really one-sided game in which Napoli actually totally dominated but just couldn't find a way through after Stefan El-Shaarawy had given Roma the lead against the run of play. Finally, Dries Mertens, who was second-half substitute, struck right at the end. Does mean that Napoli lose ground on Juventus, who beat Empoli 2-1 with a couple of goals from, guess who, Cristiano Ronaldo. There's one more big game coming up in Italy on Monday night too, with Inter-Lazio, third against fourth. Inter could pull level with Napoli if they win.
A generic thank you to Paolo Bandini on Italy. Let's go to Archie Rintuts, reporting presumably from Lucas Podolski's kebab shop.
In the Bundesliga this week, have to start again with Jadon Sancho, whose great season with Borussia Dortmund continues. Two goals against Hertha for the 18-year-old on Saturday. Not the hardest finishes in the world, it should be said, but that he is continually in the right place at the right time is not a coincidence. How could Pep Guardiola let him go from Manchester City? As one German newspaper put it, for the first time this weekend, the Dortmund fans were singing Sancho's name, and no wonder. Five goals and eight assists now in 13 games, of which he's only started five. Anyway, as he left the field, just under 20 minutes to play, Dortmund were 2-1 up, had chances to kill the game off. But in the final minute, Sancho's fellow teenage teammate Dan Axel Zagadou had a really good game, but then he gave away a penalty. Salomon Kalou, remember him, he coolly converted to make it 2-2, meaning Dortmund remained top, but now lurking 2 points behind them are, yes, you guessed it, Bayern Munich. A 2-1 win over Mainz, great first goal there from Leon Goretzka too. Mainz did equalise after halftime, but Thiago securing a third straight win for Bayern in all competitions. They move into second then, after Gladbach lost 3-1 at Freiburg on Friday night, and after what happened between Werder Bremen and Bayer Leverkusen on Sunday. Leverkusen came into the game with coach Heiko Herrlich's job seemingly on the line after a really bad start to the season, given the squad that he has at his disposal. Werder were 16 home games unbeaten under coach Florian Kohfeldt. They came into the game with one of the best defences in the league, 8 conceded in 8 games. So what happened? Werder Bremen 2, Bayer Leverkusen 6. A difficult one to explain that. So Bremen below Bayern now in fourth. Finally, started with an Englishman, so let's finish with another one, because Reece Nelson, the Arsenal loanee, had another positive impact this weekend for Hoffenheim against Stuttgart. He dribbled past 3 players before his shot was parried to teammate Joshua Brennett for Hoffenheim's first goal. And Hoffenheim went on to win that one 4-0.
Thanks, Archie, for whatever you just said. Zoltan says, question for Wilson. Did you attend any Hungarian league matches during your recent trips? And what's your opinion on the current state of Hungarian football?
I have not been to a Hungarian league game for some time. I did go to a Hungarian, well, it was a Women's Champions League qualifier, which was MTK's women's team against a team they beat really easily who weren't very good.
Well, there's your answer, Zoltan. Brent says, if you could only watch one game repeatedly for the rest of your life, which game would it be?
I think it would be that brilliant game between Holland and Portugal with about 6 red cards in it at a recent...
Yeah, I'll tell you when it was. It was the 2006 World Cup.
Yeah,
it was.
Deco and someone else ended up.
I think
were
it was. It was 18 yellows and 4 reds, and the referee was the Russian Valentin Ivanov.
Yeah, I that game immediately springs to mind as a personal favourite, despite the fact that I can remember very little about it.
I think England had played earlier that day because I was on the official media trip, and there was a big debate as to whether we should watch it or head back. And we headed back, so I missed it, and I was furious.
Jonathan says, please tell Lars that he brings shame on all of Scandinavia for not liking herring. He should at least like currying herring. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, I accept the shame. It's one of those things that I think I was forced to eat when I was too young, and I found it very disgusting, and I'm quite certain I would like it now. It's just I've been slightly traumatised, and yeah. Maybe that'll be my job for the week, to try the herring.
Callum says, Max, would you rather fight one Barry-sized chicken or 10 chicken-sized Barrys?
I reckon 10 chicken-sized Barrys would make mince meat of you.
Do you?
10 of me?
Well, they're chicken-sized.
And you can outrun them, like, so easily.
Just lock the front door, and there'd just be 10 chicken-sized Barrys pecking at the front door.
To distract them by casting cans of Guinness in their very giant direction.
But what's one... Barry-sized chicken got to do to you?
Peck.
Yeah. Oh, that's a terrifying prospect, Barry.
Yeah, but 10 chicken-sized Barrys could do a lot more damage.
I don't know.
I certainly think...
How are they going to catch him?
Run after him.
Do they have the pace of a chicken or the pace of a Barry?
If they're chicken-sized Barrys, they've got the pace of Barry, but in chicken form. With a Barry-sized chicken, it's a pace of a chicken.
To be honest, they'll all just go to that pub in Brixton. They'll just walk in and there'll be just 10 tiny Barrys sitting on bar stools.
And how would they hurt you? They've only got like little arms and they can't peck effectively.
Kick. Bite.
They'd be very small.
Barry is the animal expert, to be fair.
Speaking of our old friend, Emax, you've got a wedding present
got
there,
a wedding
Max,
present
haven't you?
Here, yes.
You need to open.
It is a bottle of champagne. There we go. This is nice.
It's a bottle of champagne which appears to be encased in a swimming pool inflatable Lilo thing. I think there's a card in there.
Is there?
Yeah. It's almost as if I opened the box while you were away on holiday.
So here's a card. Just to check. I'm just checking. Jonathan, you didn't give me a wedding present, did you?
No. No.
Lars, you didn't?
Definitely not.
I didn't even know you got married.
Barry?
No, because I wasn't invited to your wedding.
Here is the only wedding present I think I've had from anyone who works in football.
Okay.
Congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Rushton, from all at the Totally Football Show. Thank you so much, Jimbo, Ben, Ian, Rafa, James. It's greatly appreciated. It's great to be appreciated by someone in the football podcasting world.
They gave you a present. It doesn't mean they appreciate you.
Oh,
I'd get that checked as well before you open it.
Thanks for your time, Wilson.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.